Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
A disinformation tsunami.
Bots, fake accounts and real people.
I see disinformation in so many different ways.
We didn't know what to listen to. We didn't know what to follow.
Where is there reliable information?
Whose truth? Available now. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 5th of June. Climate scientists warn that the rate of global warming is at an all-time high. Four women register as candidates for Iran's presidential election, but do they stand a chance? And mass graves and body bags, what happened during the Israeli raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza? Also in the podcast, the high price being paid by the victims of sextortion.
These people are just going through the script and putting that pressure on, and they're doing it quick because then they can move on to the next person because it's about volume.
And the contribution of women to the D-Day landings 80 years ago. Given the scorching temperatures seen over the past year, it may not come as a surprise, but a new report says human activity is heating up the world at a record rate. The climate scientists behind the study are warning that the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels could be breached within 5 years. In a speech to mark World Environment Day, the UN Secretary General will warn that the world is not doing enough to switch away from coal, oil and gas. One of the authors of the new report is Karina von Schuckmann.
What we are aiming for is to provide annual tracks between the different IPCC reports, which are published every 7 years. It is clear that there is a rapid need of taking action to reduce carbon emissions. If we do not act today, the window on missing 1.5 degrees is closing.
Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath told me more about the findings.
Yes, this is a report called The Indicators of Global Change. It's being published, as you heard in the clip there, to kind of fill in the gaps when the UN's official body isn't meeting. They report about every 6 to 7 years on the state of the climate. Now, this report, as you said, highlights the fact that global warming is increasing. It's increasing at about just over a quarter of a degree Celsius per decade. That's up from the 1970s and 1980s when it was about 0.18 Celsius per decade. So they say it's at a high level, warming increasing at a rate not seen before. And they point out that last year was about 1.43 degrees warmer than the long-term average, the 1850 records. But most of that came from human activities. About 92% was that down to human activities and about 8% due to natural events such as El Nino, which we've talked about before.
This warning about the 1.5 degree threshold, is there anything that can be done?
Yes, I mean, it comes in a long line of warnings of telling people that, you know, that this threshold, which was agreed in the Paris Agreement in 2015 and is critically important to developing states and small island states, that threshold should be gone, could be gone, surpassed in 5 years or so. That's obviously the nature of the warning is very stark from, and we'll hear probably later today from the UN Secretary General more about that. And countries are girding up to try and put plans in place to cut emissions to that level. But at the moment, those emissions are still going up. They may be slowing down in their rise, but they're still going up, and that puts that target very much in danger. And most scientists would admit privately it's a goner.
We keep hearing scepticism from some politicians that people are willing to take action. So if it's a goner, are we going to have to think about perhaps a new strategy?
Yes, indeed. I'm sure that is informing the minds of scientists and politicians. I think the big question with these type of reports, the big issue really here that scientists really worry about is whether or not the rate of warming is accelerating and whether we're going to hit some tripping points that will really make things much worse. Now, while the rate of increase seen in these reports and today's report is the highest on record, the scientists take some comfort from the fact that it's not beyond the bounds of what they predicted. Essentially, it's where they said we would be at several decades ago. It's not going any faster than that. And that is some small comfort in this particular report.
Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath. The Gaza ceasefire plan set out by President Biden last week has still not been agreed by Hamas or by Israel, where the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir today stepped up his opposition to it. The proposal is due to be discussed by security officials from the US, Egypt and Qatar. But as the talking goes on, Israel has announced a new military campaign in central Gaza. Nearly 8 months after the 7th of October massacre, it has been unable to defeat Hamas and has returned to the scene of previous battles. In March, Israel carried out a second raid on Al-Shifa Hospital, where it said it killed more than 200 terrorists without a single civilian casualty. However, the BBC has found evidence that civilians were killed. From Istanbul, our Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf has this report, which some listeners may find distressing.
On the 1st of April, Palestinians poured over the ruins of what was once Gaza's biggest hospital. Israeli forces had just ended their second military raid at Al-Shifa. Since then, local search teams say they have found four mass graves and have dug up hundreds of bodies at the site. It's led to international calls for an investigation into possible war crimes. Rami Dababish from the Palestinian Civil Defense told us of suspicious finds.
We've discovered bodies of women and children and people without heads, as well as torn body parts.
The Israeli military says it did exhume bodies which Palestinians had buried earlier, as it searched for hostages seized by Hamas. But some of those found in the graves were patients. Walid Fatima believes his elderly mother Lena died of malnutrition and dehydration. Her corpse was badly decomposed.
I identified her from particular marks on her legs. She'd been wounded in November and had a toe amputated on each foot.
Israel blames any deaths of patients on natural causes. But the local representative of the World Health Organization, Dr. Rick Peppercorn, who went to visit Al-Shifa, says those trapped endured horrific conditions.
During the siege, 20 patients died. There were patients who couldn't get oxygen. There was not proper medication, but also the food and water. There were stories that 15 people had to share one bottle of water.
Israel's army says Palestinian gunmen were based inside Al-Shifa and killed more than 200 Hamas and Islamic Jihad operatives in a space of 2 weeks. The Israeli government spokesman Avi Hyman gave a briefing at the end of the raid.
Shifa has become a main terrorism command center for Hamas. The surprise action by our forces was precise and surgical.
But the fighting with Palestinian armed groups reached the streets around the hospital. There was widespread destruction. I spoke to witnesses who told me that many civilians had been killed. One man told me he was a sole survivor of an Israeli airstrike that killed 23 members of his family.
This was somebody who wanted to develop as a well-rounded surgeon who was utterly committed to his people and to work in Gaza.
Dr. Ahmed Al-Makadma was a dedicated surgeon. He was shot dead close to the hospital where he worked. The BBC spoke to a top British plastic surgeon, Tim Goodacre, who helped train him.
He was hungry for knowledge. He was a very gentle and somebody who all of us would want to have as our sort of doctors.
Dr. Ahmed was off shift and at home near Al-Shifa Hospital when Israeli forces moved in. He was stuck there for 4 days and interrogated by Israeli soldiers. Dr. Ahmed then tried to leave Gaza City on foot with his mother Yusra. His father, Saeed, told us they found his decomposed body 11 days after he disappeared. The Israel's military says it's unaware of the death of the surgeon and his mother. Many in Gaza are still searching for their loved ones who have been missing since the raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in April. International forensic experts cannot access the site, and many worried that full truth of what happened here may never be uncovered.
Our Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu Alouf. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi told his supporters yesterday he was, quote, very, very happy with the outcome of the general election. But he can't have been too pleased to lose his majority, getting 160 fewer seats than he'd been aiming for. Instead of presiding over a supermajority, which would allow him to change the constitution, he's now having to build a coalition in order to govern. But what does that mean for the Indian economy? Here's our India business correspondent, Arunade Mukherjee.
Earlier, the BJP, with absolute majority, had no compulsion to take other parties along whenever it needed to enact laws or outline spending. But now, for the first time since 2014, India is back to an era of coalition politics, which means consensus will be key. India might be one of the fastest growing economies in the world, but there are challenges ahead for the next 5 years. Unemployment among India's educated youth has increased. Inequality has widened to a 100-year high, and manufacturing as a share of GDP has remained stagnant for a decade. As India aims to become the third largest economy in the world in the next 3 years, the next 5 years for the government in power will be key. And with coalition politics back, the question is, will economics drive politics, or will politics drive economics?
Arunade Mukherjee in Delhi. And as we record this podcast, we've just heard a statement from India that the Modi-led alliance has now agreed to form the next Indian government. Last week, a snap election was announced in Iran following the death of President Raisi in a helicopter crash. Candidate registration closed on Monday with 80 people signing up, including 4 women. But in the 45-year history of the Islamic Republic, no woman has ever been allowed to stand for Iranian president. So will they this time? I asked Farhanak Amidi, the World Service Women's Affairs reporter.
I really find that unlikely to happen. With the situation we are seeing right now in Iran, with clampdown on women and normalization of violence against women on the streets and pavements across the country by morality police, it is very unlikely to see that you're going to have a female president or to be able to even run for a presidency and pass the vetting, because the system, as a lot of Iranian women's rights activists and political activists call the regime, a gender apartheid. The whole system is designed to keep women, at the best of the situations, second-class citizens. So it is very unlikely for that to happen and for them to actually pass the vetting. No woman has ever passed the vetting of the Council of Experts.
Given that, why would they put their names forward?
Well, a lot of people might look at it and think that these women are there to push boundaries and challenge the status quo. I mean, there was one woman who was doing that back in the 90s, and she registered twice. That was the late Azam Talaghani. But these women, from what they are saying, the speeches they've done after the registration, they basically say that we've been so loyal to the Constitution, to the Supreme Leader, and they are kind of demanding a reward for their loyalty rather than thinking or planning to push boundaries. None of these women, these 4 women, in their slogans for their to-be campaigns have even mentioned women. None of them. So women's rights, women's issues are not part of their agenda. And that is quite telling, because we have seen women protesting in Iran and being on the forefront of the protests, of the so-called woman life freedom protests in the country, across the country. And it's quite telling that none of these female candidates are even mentioning women in their slogans.
I was going to ask you, I mean, after the death of Mahsa Amini and those protests against the strict Islamic dress that women are forced to wear in Iran, I was wondering if there might be perhaps some kind of rethinking at the top, that maybe they have to slightly ease conditions for women.
That's not actually what we have seen on the streets of Iran. Women have been pushing boundaries, and we are seeing acts of defiance every day on the pavements of every city in Iran. But that's not what the authorities and the establishment are saying. Basically, they have made things more difficult. You know, women are being penalized for their dress code. They are being beaten and kicked on the pavement. Some of the videos that are coming out of Iran are extremely worrying, because this is a patriarchal society where women generally are victims of domestic violence in their own homes. And then you are seeing the police force kicking and beating them for their hijab. And that kind of normalizes violence against women. And the clergy and the hardline establishment keep on saying that women's rights is a red line, is a no-no, and they are not going to compromise at all. So women are pushing forward and they are fighting, but we are not really seeing a response that shows any kind of silver lining for women's rights at the moment.
So do we see any women in any position of political power at all in Iran?
We see them as MPs. We have seen one minister, health minister, that was, I think, two presidents before. And we see them at heads of some government-funded organizations, but not really in decision-making positions, because even, you know, in this system, women cannot even be judges, so let alone be presidents or decision makers politically.
Farhanak Amidi, the BBC World Service Women's Affairs reporter. Still to come on the Global News podcast, she spent 4 years in prison before being cleared of the murder of a British student in Italy. Now Amanda Knox has been convicted of slander by a judge in Florence.
A world of social media where there's bubbles of conflicting opinions.
All kinds of wrong and misleading information.
Conspiracy theories.
Plants for various nefarious figures.
This has changed our world.
Whose Truth is the documentary series from the BBC World Service exploring misinformation in the digital age. Join me, Babita Sharma, as I hear from the Nobel laureates and young activists trying to tackle it.
Climate refugees can also lead climate action.
Listen now by searching for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was a feud that led Australia's Prime Minister to call Elon Musk an arrogant billionaire. The row centred on video footage posted on X of an incident last April when a bishop and priest were stabbed in their Sydney church. The authorities tried to get the content removed. Mr. Musk refused, and it looks like he's won, with Australia now abandoning that legal effort. Our correspondent in Sydney, Katie Watson, told Paul Moss why Australia's online safety regulator had decided not to pursue the case.
Well, in a statement, she said that the sole goal and focus in issuing the initial removal notice was to prevent extremely violent footage from going viral, and obviously with the concern of potentially inciting further violence and inflicting more harm on the Australian community. And of course, I mean, we did see this was a stabbing that was live streamed, and there were riots in the wake of the stabbing as well. So she said, though, that after weighing multiple considerations, including litigation across multiple cases, she considered this option likely to achieve the most positive outcome for the online safety of all Australians, and that's especially children.
This was very violent footage. I mean, does that mean that X is now free to host whatever graphic content it wants to?
Not exactly. I mean, even in this statement that the commissioner has put out, is cited X's CEO as talking to the European Commission in October, saying that there are clear rules that prohibit violent, hateful entities, perpetrators of violent attacks, violent speech. And in fact, the CEO is quoted as saying that we strictly adhere to policies concerning illegal content and removing illegal content, including terrorist content, from our platform. So, you know, they're not free to go and do what they like, but certainly this has caused a huge controversy as to, you know, how far, what powers regulators have, and indeed what exactly is free speech.
You mentioned the fight that broke out after the stabbing. I mean, this was an incident that obviously aroused strong feelings in the community. So how's the decision been received that the footage of it can carry on being displayed?
Well, this has been a debate. Of course, we've heard that Prime Minister Albanese, he called Elon Musk an arrogant, out-of-touch billionaire. Elon Musk said that this was censorship. And, it, you know, that's the debate that's played out. Exactly what role and what power does a regulator have to be able to remove content? And the sticking point was not just removing it from Australia, but removing it globally because of the graphic footage. Or indeed, you know, what rights do people have to be able to access this? Of course, it wasn't completely, you know, people were still able to access it through VPNs. It wasn't removed totally. So the debate really about, you know, is this free speech? Is this government over control, you know, too much control from the government? And that's a debate that will carry on.
Briefly, Katie, what's the legal position? Is there's now further legal proceedings, a review?
So the commissioner has said that she's, you know, focusing on a review. There are other litigation issues currently going on with X. But this, you know, this is the big news, the fact that it's no longer going to be pursuing the legal battle. Everybody's quite interested in that, even though there is a review going on. And what will come out of that review, of course, and there's a select committee inquiry into social media, and that will be the focus for the commission.
Katie Watson in Sydney. The authorities in South Korea say North Korea is demolishing sections of a railway built to connect the two countries. More details from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
The inter-Korean railway was heralded as a clear step towards peace between the Koreas when it was unveiled in the year 2000, allowing train travel across their heavily fortified border. But since then, relations have deteriorated. Pyongyang has taken steps to eliminate connections after declaring several months ago that Korean reunification was no longer a goal. North Korea has been developing close ties with Russia, while South Korea has bolstered its relations with Japan and the US.
Celia Hatton. An American mother whose son killed himself within 6 hours of being targeted by sextortion scammers is campaigning to raise awareness about how swift and callous these criminals can be. Jordan DeMay died after two Nigerian brothers blackmailed him with explicit images of himself. The two men are now awaiting sentencing. Two other Nigerians have been arrested after an Australian schoolboy killed himself in April. The head of Nigerian cyber police has told the BBC they go to great lengths to stop sextortion gangs. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy has this investigation.
Jordan was targeted by a sextortion gang. They messaged him on Instagram, pretending to be a girl his age, and coaxed him into sending explicit images. They then blackmailed him, demanding money in exchange for not sharing the pictures. Jordan sent some, but it wasn't enough.
It was less than 6 hours from the time that Jordan started communicating till the time he ultimately took his life. There's actually like a script online, and these people are just going through the script and putting that pressure on. And they're doing it quick because then they can move on to the next person because it's about volume.
Since Jordan died, Jen Buta has become an active campaigner, raising awareness about sextortion to young people and parents.
But if you haven't talked to your children about sextortion and what happens, go get them right now, immediately. Sit them down, talk to them.
On TikTok, her videos have now had more than 1 million likes.
I get messages all the time from parents reaching out asking what to do.
US crime figures show sextortion cases more than doubled last year, rising to 26,700. In the US alone, at least 27 boys killed themselves in the last 2 years. In the UK last month, police put out a warning to schools and young people.
What happened to Jordan in Marquette, here in the north of the US, has become a focal point in the ongoing discussions about how to solve sextortion. It's a growing global problem with victims all over the world. But there's one country where a disproportionate number of these cybercriminals seems to be based.
According to researchers, a large number of scammers come from West Africa, specifically Nigeria. Two brothers from Lagos admitted to targeting Jordan. Samuel Ogoshi, who's 22, and Samson Ogoshi, who's 20, were extradited to the US and are awaiting sentencing. Message records show the criminals were callous. When Jordan told them he might kill himself if they released the pictures, they replied, "Do that fast, or I'll make you do it." Two other Nigerians were arrested in April, linked to the suicide of an Australian schoolboy. Nigerian authorities have long been accused of not doing enough, but in the last year they've been rounding up young men and arresting them for what's described as internet fraud. Last year, Nigeria's cybercrime police published a dramatic promotional video of their activity,
My account has been hacked,
showing police raiding cyber gangs with guns. Head of the division, Director Ifeanyi Henry, defends his force's action to stop the criminals.
People that believe that Nigeria is not doing enough is laughable. I use the word laughable because the government of Nigeria spent billions of naira to provide, to establish a national cybercrime center like this. The work is actually ongoing. We are not taking it, you know, things for granted with regards to anything concerning sextortion in particular. And they know this, and we're giving them very serious hits. A lot have been prosecuted, a lot have been arrested.
The police say other gangs in Southeast Asia are also to blame and that Nigerian teens are being targeted too. But cyber experts like Dr. Robinson Tumbari from Digital Footprints in Nigeria worry that sextortion and other cyber fraud has become normalised to Nigeria's large, young, tech-savvy population.
The main triggers is actually socioeconomic in nature. So, you know, it's become almost like a mainstream activities where they don't really think too much about the consequences, but just go in all the same because, you know, a colleague is going in and, you know, making money and all of that.
Jordan John DeMay with High Achievement.
Meanwhile, in Michigan, Jen continues her campaign in memory of her son, who couldn't be there to collect his high school honours.
Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy. It was a brutal killing that shocked the world. In 2007, British student Meredith Kircher was stabbed to death in her apartment in the Italian city of Perugia. Her flatmate, American Amanda Knox, spent 4 years in prison for the murder before finally being cleared in 2015. Now, a judge in a court in Florence has convicted Amanda Knox of slander. Our reporter in Rome, Davide Giglione, gave us this update.
We were just listening to Amanda Knox's lawyers who came out straight after the judge read the verdict, and they said that their client, Amanda Knox, was extremely disappointed because she was hoping to clear her name once and for all. Obviously, this trial was not about the murder because she's been acquitted. She was acquitted for that in 2015. But the slander trial was now taking place in Florence after she was previously accused, and then there was a retrial. So it's all very legally complicated. This legal battle started back in 2007 when a British student, Meredith Kircher, was murdered, and she was Amanda Knox's flatmate. Then Amanda Knox was accused and convicted, found guilty first of the murder. Then she was acquitted. Then she was found guilty again. Then she was acquitted once and for all for the murder in 2015. Now, this is a separate trial for the slander because when she was interrogated 4 days after the murder, she accused another man who was not involved of the murder of Kircher, and she wrote his name on a piece of paper. Today, during the trial, she read a spontaneous statement in Italian where she basically accused Italian police back in the day of treating her badly. She said she was confused, and she said that was the worst night of her entire life, and she was hoping to, you know, be acquitted, obviously. Now, lawyers said that they will wait for the motivation for the sentence, which will be published within the next 60 days, and they will probably appeal.
Davide Giglione in Rome. Commemorations to mark the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings have begun in Britain and France. King Charles and the US President Joe Biden will join around 200 World War II veterans in northern France tomorrow, the 6th of June, to mark the Allied assault on the Normandy beaches. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history and played a big part in the Allied victory over the Nazis. As well as those who fought on the beaches, there were others, particularly women, who helped with the war effort elsewhere. We heard from two of them.
My name is Patricia Davis. Used to be Patricia Outram during the war when I was in the Women's Royal Naval Service. Because I knew German, I was in a branch where we did a lot of secret work.
My name is Christian Lamb. I was a third officer in the Rems. I had an interesting job making maps for the invasion.
At the time of D-Day, I was 20, and I'm now just coming up in June to my 100th and first birthday, which seems over the top.
When I was only 23, when I was working on the maps of D-Day, I'm now 103.
We collected the codes because we listened to the German broadcasts, but we sent them on immediately to Bletchley Park.
I hoped to do the best I could by getting these particular detailed maps for the places where the soldiers were going to land.
On the 6th of June 1944, the great secret is divulged.
I think one morning I was sitting reading and I saw a little party of people coming up, and to my great astonishment, I recognised the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill wanted to be seen looking at the coast near Calais to give an impression that that's where the landings were going to be when they were going to be 40 miles to the west down in Normandy. And apparently he was seen, and that was reported, and the Germans did hear about it. So it was a tiny bit of history.
It's interesting to reflect how the word invasion has swung round to mean something gratifying to Britain.
You could feel the atmosphere growing and growing and growing, and you knew that something enormously proud and splendid was about to take place, but you didn't know when.
Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number one, and in a few seconds I will read it to you.
And so, of course, the very morning when I turned on the radio at 5 a.m, or something like that, and heard that they had started. Go was the word, and it was a most amazingly thrilling moment of my life.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
D-Day is probably the most important day. It may not be that many people of this generation have ever heard about it, or if they have, they don't mean much to them.
Even having quite a minor view of it, we did have a small part to play in D-Day. I hope D-Day goes on being remembered, and that children particularly are told about the significance of it, because it was important.
Voices of Patricia Davis and Christiane Lam sharing their experiences of D-Day. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by James Piper and produced by Oliver Burlow. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
A world of social media where there's bubbles of conflicting opinions.
All kinds of wrong and misleading information.
Conspiracy theories.
Plants for various nefarious figures.
This has changed our world.
Whose Truth is a documentary series from the BBC World Service exploring misinformation in the digital age. Join me, Babita Sharma, as I hear from the Nobel laureates and young activists trying to tackle it.
Climate refugees can also lead climate action.
Listen now by searching for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.